Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 20th of October. Before we get rolling today, we spent a lot of the week last week in Pledge Drive, and we had a rip-roaring great Pledge Drive, so thank you so much. And we did it in half the time. Everything worked well. It was terrific. Nearly 9,500 listeners pledged. We welcome over 2,600 new members, and you donated over $1 million to fund Wisconsin Public Radio and the programs that you depend on. Thank you so much for all that you gave and for listening. It was just very successful. And I hope an indication that we can do this kind of thing again. So thanks. Today we're going to be examining the GOP field of presidential candidates, the first hour of our program today. On Tuesday, the candidates faced off in Nevada for their sixth debate. Texas Governor Rick Perry, former Governor Mitt Romney, Minnesota Representative Michelle Bachmann, former Godfather's Pizza CEO Herman Cain, former U.S. Senator Rick Santorum, Congressman Ron Paul from Texas, and the former Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich, squared off over the economy, taxes, immigration, education. It was a pretty lively debate on Tuesday. And joining us this hour to examine that debate and where this whole field is going, why is it that Herman Cain is still at the top, but is Mitt Romney the presumed candidate here? He is a senior editorial writer for the Washington Examiner. He worked as Washington correspondent for the American Spectator and also was a financial reporter at Reuters in New York. We'd like to hear from you this hour, what you think of the debate, what you think of the 999 plan or Romney and Perry's competing economic plans, the debate, which got rather contentious on Tuesday about immigration. You can join the program, as always. Here's the number, 800-486-8655 for you to join our conversation. Philip Klein, hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks very much, Philip, for being with us. So give me your examination and reasons why you think Herman Cain is at the top of this field. I mean, it's a tenuous hold, but he's been there for a little while now. What's going on?
I think that what you see is that, and what we've seen throughout this race, is that a lot of conservatives are very reluctant to get behind Mitt Romney for a number of reasons. The one being his, particularly his health care plan in Massachusetts, which bears striking similarities to the national health care law, there's a lot of evidence that President Obama effectively used that as the model for the national law. And also the fact that has a history of having reversed himself on a number of issues. So that sort of gives a lot of conservatives pause that now that he's saying certain things that are more conservative, whether conservatives could really trust that that's where he stands or where he'd govern as president, given that in the past he's shown the ability to sort of change positions. So for those and a variety of reasons, conservatives are very reluctant to get behind Mitt Romney. So what we've seen throughout the race is various candidates compete for the role of being the anti-Romney. Tim Pawlenty was hoping to be that person, but then Michelle Bachmann came into the race, and she kind of had a boomlet that kind of peaked with her winning the straw poll in Ames, Iowa in August. She kind of faded when Rick Perry got in, and he sort of benefited from the anti-Romney vote and surge to the top of the field. But after a series of lackluster debate performances, he then faded, and Cain was the primary beneficiary. And Cain has been able to sort of tap into a sort of anti-establishment wave and use the fact that he has never served in political office. Instead of being a disadvantage, he's used that to his advantage to say, look, I'm not one of these politicians. I'm a businessman, and here's my, here's my policy. And he's also had this sort of simple and catchy 999 policy. Now, with all this said, I think that Herman Cain is going to have major problems, because it's a lot easier to go from nowhere to sort of be the sort of enjoy a sort of surge. But the question is that how do you withstand scrutiny once you're in that level? And Cain is when you're sort of at the back of the pack, you have the luxury of sort of shooting from the hip and saying things. If you're likable, people sort of say that they support you, and you can surge to the top of the polls. But once you're there and you're sort of a genuine contender, then you start coming under more scrutiny. I think you saw that in this week's debate as the candidates all went after his 999 tax plan.
Mm-hmm.
And today you're seeing that he's coming under fire for confusing statements he's made on abortion. Last night he told Piers Morgan that he believed in life and conception, but then he sort of said that it should be up to the, it shouldn't be government's decision, it should be up to the woman and the family, and it wasn't clear if he was just talking about in the instance of rape or incest, but there are a number of prior interviews that he's given that now that he's a contender people are looking at, that have seemed to give mixed signals about where he stands on abortion. So, I mean, basically, without knowing where the whole abortion thing will wind up, the point is that his statements are going to start to come under a lot more scrutiny now, and I think that's, you know, that's going to be, that could, you could see this bubble burst.
You have to believe, because he talks about it all the time, that the 999 idea is resonating among voters, and yet it doesn't seem to be resonating with any of the other Republican presidential candidates. They're all, as you said, roundly criticizing him for this. Is that a fair analysis of it, that people seem to find this appealing, but there are problems with it?
The people that don't necessarily get into the nuances of tax policy like the language of saying, look, we're going to scrap this confusing tax code with millions of pages and, you know, just have this 999 plan, and it's simple and easy and people remember it. When you get into the details of the tax policy, there are a lot of issues on it that have been raised both from the right and the left. I mean, one criticism is, you know, will it raise enough revenue? Another criticism is, will poor people bear more of a burden? Because basically, in any sales tax, one of the problems is that you run the risk of having it disproportionately fall on lower-income people because they spend a higher percentage of their money. So if you earn $35,000 a year and you have to spend all that money, then, you know, you're paying the 9% sales tax on all your income. Whereas if somebody makes $500,000 a year and doesn't spend that much money, as high a percentage of his income on, you know, goods and services, then they're not paying that 9% on all their income.
Right.
So in that way, there's a sort of the risk of it being very falling disproportionately on poor people. But also there's the view that for a long time, you know, for time immemorial, conservatives have fought the idea of a VAT tax or a national sales tax like in Europe. Now, it's true that some people have gotten behind the idea of a consumption-based tax or national sales tax, typically called a fair tax. However, people who support a fair tax, typically that goes hand in hand with saying we're going to get rid of the income tax and repeal the amendment to the Constitution that allowed Congress to tax income. And so if you do those things, then conservatives are, you know, more comfortable with saying, okay, we're going to have a consumption-based tax, and maybe you make certain exemptions for food or areas to make it less disproportionately on the poor. So I think some conservatives are okay with that idea. But the problem is that Kane doesn't build, doesn't scrap the income tax in terms of repealing the income tax amendment. So what you wind up with is this 999 plan. And the concern is that even if, let's say, Herman Cain gets elected and somehow is able to pass this plan, all, you know, which is, you know, doubtful, but let's just say that that's the case. The problem is the conservative fear is that once you create this new tax, this new national sales tax, that when Democrats get in, they'll start, you know, hiking that up, maybe by a half a point, a point here and there. And what happens is that over time, the 999 plan could become the 15-17-19 plan or, mm-hmm. or something, some combination of that. And that's the big fear about among conservatives who sort of look at tax policy a lot. That's the big fear. And the question is, from my perspective, is Cain's likability and the sort of more simplified rhetoric, you know, you see it took me a couple minutes to sort of outline right. the flaws in the 999 plan. Herman Cain could just get up there and say, look, we just want to simplify this tax code and, you know, get rid of all these crazy loopholes and deductions and these millions of pages of nonsense. And, you know, that has a certain appeal to people. So we'll see how he's able to hold up as it comes under more scrutiny.
The one more question from me, and then we'll go to phone calls. The other issue that was a lightning rod issue on many fronts was immigration. His call for a barbed wire fence, electric fence, you know, he said it was a joke and then it wasn't a joke. And also Mitt Romney employing somebody who was illegal to mow his lawn. A couple questions here. Is this a huge issue among conservatives? And is there a cohesive plan? And what in the world was Herman Cain talking about? Is it legitimate for Mitt Romney to be criticized for who mowed his lawn?
Okay, well, there are a few things. I think that the immigration issue is important for conservatives. Certainly, for some conservatives, it's extremely important. However, what we've seen historically is that the intensity of the sentiment over immigration tends to, conservatives tend to become really passionate about it when there's a chance that something will actually get done at the national level that they hate. And then it sort of tapers off a little in terms of not that people don't change their views on immigration, but the sort of intensity changes. And I think that you saw that sort of with the McCain campaign. Now, McCain, unlike any of the other candidates, not only had positions on immigration that put him to, you know, outside the mainstream of where a lot of conservatives are, but he was actually leading the effort along with Ted Kennedy to pass legislation the conservatives hated on immigration. So as a result of that, he you know, he sort of completely tanked in the polls. But a few months later, he was able to sort of survive the issue by saying, look, I realized that, you know, but because the whole effort went down in flames, he was able to survive the issue by saying, oh, look, I support border security first. And I realized that. And that sort of survived the issue. So clearly it's an important issue, but it may not be a, you know, killer issue one way or the other. Certainly Rick Perry got into trouble when he said that if you disagreed with his policy of providing in-state tuition to illegal to the children of illegal immigrants, that you don't have a heart. Because, I mean, conservatives don't want to be called heartless. They're used to liberals calling them that. So that was a major bungle, and Romney had dug in on that. So Perry sort of wanted to point out that Romney hasn't exactly been consistent on immigration. Now, it's true that back during the last campaign, one of the controversies that Mitt Romney got into was the fact that that he had illegal immigrants working on his lawn and tending to his property. And this was a story that the Boston newspapers had reported. And then the problem that he got into was that after this sort of became a minor dust-up early in the last campaign, a year later they did a follow-up and found out that he was still employing the same lawn care company that was still had illegal immigrants working for it. So that's why it became a big issue. With Romney, the issue has always been that not necessarily about where he stands on immigration. It's that he's sort of attacking people on immigration as if he has a pristine conservative record on immigration when he doesn't. And I think that the bigger issue beyond this sort of issue of this lawn care company thing, which is kind of, which is kind of like this kind of gotcha, sort of tabloidy type controversy. The bigger things, I think, when you look at Mitt Romney is, one is that he was quoted in the Boston Globe shortly before he ran for president last time around, saying that he supported the McCain-Kennedy version of the immigration reform. He called it reasonable and quite different from amnesty. And then when he ran for president last time, he attacked McCain on immigration, saying that his plan was pure amnesty. Also, Romney will say, he'll frequently boast about how he deputized state troopers to be able to, report illegal immigrants if they get pulled over or something. The problem is that even though Romney did technically do that, he actually decided to issue that order 3 weeks before he left office as governor. So his Democratic successor had already been elected and said he'd overturn that order as soon as he got in. But Mitt Romney, just as he was on the cusp of running for president as a Republican, issued this order that his Democratic successor quickly overturned weeks later, and now he sort of boasts about it as to sort of say that he was tough on immigration. And it's sort of like the kid who, grazes the bristles of a toothbrush against his teeth to tell his mom that he brushed his teeth.
Philip Klein is our guest this hour. He is senior editorial writer for the Washington Examiner. We're looking at the Republican presidential field. Yet another debate this week. So we were talking about why it is that Herman Cain is the front runner. Mitt Romney, is he indeed the probable nominee here? Immigration issues, economic plans, and the whole tone of the debate, which we have yet to get to. We're welcoming phone calls for him. Our phone number is... Excuse me, I had to sneeze. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. To your phone calls, Dan in Three Lakes, our first caller. Hi, Dan.
Good morning. I would like to take a minute to explain a few things about this 999 tax of Herman Cain's and what people do not understand. What it means is eliminate all deductions and exemptions. Then there will be a 9% tax on your wages, 100% of your wages. A 9% tax if you're on Social Security or a pension. A 9% income tax on the Social Security and pension income. Then there will be a 9% sales tax, and that'll be on top of Wisconsin's 5% or 5.5% sales tax, depending on where you live. Then There is not now, and nobody understands this, especially Joe Sixpack, there is not now, and there never has been, a tax on corporations or businesses, an income tax, that the business does not recover. How many years would it take for a business paying income taxes that it didn't recover through the cost of its sales to go broke? It's just a matter of divide the rate of the tax that's paid by the number of years to make it 100%, and the business would go broke. So the taxes supposedly paid by corporations are actually paid by individuals and the customers of those corporations in added prices. What this means is 9% from your wages, 9% from your purchases, and 9% to cover the additional taxes paid by supposedly paid by corporations, which is 27%, plus 5% from the state, which gets you up to 32%, plus 8% for your Medicare and Social Security taxes, which gets you up to 50%. So there would be a 50% income tax on wage earners under this plan. That is why it is so incredibly stupid, and I will listen to
that. All right. Thanks very much for the call, Dan. Philip.
Yeah, I mean, it's without getting into all the minutiae, I don't think that's quite right, because you can't just sort of simply add up all the numbers as he did. So and just keep adding the nines and the six, and it just doesn't exactly add up that way. I mean, I do agree that the thing is, for instance, he mentions the corporate tax currently. The corporate tax is, 35%. So if the caller is concerned about corporate income tax getting passed on to the consumer, that happens now under the current system. So this would bring the corporate tax down to 9% and get rid of a bunch of loopholes and deductions and so forth. So I think that you have to compare it relative to the current tax system. I do agree that a sales tax, as I said before, runs the risk, if not properly designed, to fall disproportionately on lower incomes because, as I said, people with lower incomes tend to save less and they just have to consume more of their income by spending money on stuff.
Do the Republicans need to come up with a solid plan, considering what's going on with these demonstrations all over the world, Philip, and this concern that people aren't getting the average guy and gal isn't getting a very good deal here, and some people who are making a whole lot of money are getting very, very good deals. How should they, if you were advising them, respond to Occupy Wall Street, Occupy all kinds of cities?
Well, I think that they should respond with the facts. The truth is that top 1% pay a disproportionate amount of federal income tax. The top 5 or 10% pay an overwhelming majority of the taxes. So this idea that somehow they're not paying their fair share is just, simply not accurate. It's not reflected by the facts. The top 1% pay much more in taxes than they earn relative to the country. And so they should just respond with that. And I also think that Republicans shouldn't overinterpret these protests. I mean, what you have is, there's an encampment right across the street from my office in D.C. It's a few dozen tents. In Occupy Wall Street, you're talking about a few hundred people. They've been smart about sort of deploying people in places where there's a large media presence. And it's very easy, I could walk across the street from my office, which happens to be down the street from the Washington Post, and interview protesters. And there's about 100 people there, 50, sometimes a few dozen at any given time, and that it makes it out like it's the biggest thing in the world. I think in most places, it's not. It's not sort of this big, mass, broad movement that's very representative of all of America.
We welcome more phone calls. Let's go to Mark in La Crosse. Hi, Mark.
Hey, I listened to the debate the other night, and I'd have to say when they were focusing on the 999 and Kane responded with the apple and the orange comment, I think he came across to me as not being specific, just throwing that out. And then when he was pressed by Romney, I didn't think he handled himself very well at all. I think it's interesting that when he was interviewed by CNN, he mentioned they asked who he thought were the other strongest candidates that would be good presidents, and he mentioned that it would be Mitt Romney and also Newt Gingrich were the two that came to mind. I think he isn't going to last very long, and I'm conservative, but I believe that Romney and the state-level health care component that he was behind, I believe that's the right way to go. I think something has to be done. And I think that it should be done on the state level, and I think that should be the person that's who I'm throwing my weight behind, and I think he's presented himself extremely strong in the debates, and I think he'd be the best candidate for the Republicans.
Thank you, Mark, for your call.
Yes, well, a few points on that. First, I think that, I mean, it's worth pointing out that Kane actually endorsed Mitt Romney the last time around. He's joked since then that, well, that's because he wasn't running. But now that he's running, he thinks he's the best candidate. But on the health care plan, I think it just sort of depends on your perspective. Mitt Romney's health care plan in Massachusetts is completely incompatible with conservatism. His plan contains all the main features that existed in, Obama's health care plan that conservatives hate. It forces individuals to purchase insurance under the threat of the fine. It sets up exchanges that are run by government and that in which government bureaucrats design health care plans and say what the health care plans have to be. Because everybody's mandated to purchase insurance, the government has to define what counts as insurance. That falls to bureaucrats in Massachusetts. It falls to the Secretary of HHS and under the, President Obama's law. Both laws rely on expanding the insurance pool by expanding Medicaid. And another thing that Romney doesn't talk about is that a lot of his rhetoric is about how it was a state-based solution. However, what happened in reality was that half of the cost of the Massachusetts plan was paid for by the federal government through the Medicaid program. So it's not really, it's kind of disingenuous for Romney to say it didn't really affect the federal government at all, because federal taxpayers are subsidizing the Massachusetts plan and still are. There was a report this week that the Massachusetts healthcare system has cost skyrocketing out of control. The whole idea of a mandate theoretically was supposed to reduce unwanted hospital visits or unnecessary visits to the emergency room. Yet those have actually gone up under Romney Care. And the question is, well, is that counterintuitive? If more people are insured, why are more people going to the hospital room? The reason is that they increased insurance, but there's nothing in there to increase the number of medical providers. So there are less people. It's harder to get a doctor's appointment, so people are showing up at emergency rooms for routine services. If you want to see what President Obama's health care law is going to do to the country, you can look toward Massachusetts. Sure, it's not as bad because a state can't quite do as certain things as the federal government. It's all because it's not sweeping. It doesn't apply to all 50 states like the health care law. But I think that that's kind of a weak argument for Romney to make, because if we were to adopt that logic, the idea that Romney pursued this plan at the state level and he shouldn't be judged on it, then basically that any governor running for office can basically use the states' rights argument to get around any criticism of any policy as, you know, that he made when he was governor. So if a Republican running for president raised taxes, he can say, look, I just raised state taxes. I don't support raising taxes at a national level. And you can go, you know, right on down the list. So, and the bottom line is, you know, if you agree with President Obama's approach to health care, then the, you know, I can understand defending the approach that Romney took in Massachusetts. But philosophically, structurally, they're so similar that I just don't understand how anybody who's not working for the Romney campaign could say that the national health care law is an abomination and Romney's health care law was a great solution.
We talked with one of the people who fashioned both laws on our show yesterday, actually, from Massachusetts, and I would agree with you that there a lot of the healthcare reform is similar. I do think that. Tell me what you think about this. He was saying he was citing polls showing that 70% of people in Massachusetts are okay with this plan, and healthcare costs, of course, are rising all over, which we need to get a handle on. But people are pretty pleased with this. The governor is coming up, the current governor is coming up with something that may be even more radical, giving lump sum payments for an individual, for a hospital, for a person's care, which creates all kinds of questions. But what happened is that it seemed to me as though that Romney could say, listen, it may not be perfect, but we're the only state in the country that insures 99% of our people and all children, and that's a good thing, and leave it at there. Couldn't he do that?
No. I mean, he could, but there's a few problems with that. One, I mean, the polls are kind of all over the place on the Massachusetts healthcare system, depending on how you word the question. He obviously cites the most favorable polls. If you ask people a question, a blanket question, you know, are you satisfied with the United States healthcare system? 80 to 85% of people in most polls will say that, yes, they're satisfied. And then if you ask them, do you think it needs, you know, major changes, then you could find majorities of people saying that, yes, it needs major changes. So I don't think that that's the best sort of gauge. Another thing is that the sort of general voter in Massachusetts isn't very indicative of the conservative voter in a Republican primary, because obviously Massachusetts is one of the more liberal states in the country. So I don't think that's a good indication of where everyone else is. In terms of the access, look, the problem in terms of what you say about expanding coverage, the bottom line is that the problem, and this is an issue that President Obama got wrong and Mitt Romney got wrong, is that the problem isn't insurance. The problem isn't that we need to get more people insured. The problem is that we need to bring health care costs down. And if you bring health care costs down, it can become more accessible to people because it's cheaper. But what Obama does and what Romney does is they say, let's reverse engineer it and get more people in the system without addressing the cost. And you're seeing the problem with that in Massachusetts, is that increasing insurance doesn't necessarily mean increased access because of the waiting times that exist to get to see a doctor, because people have to show up at emergency rooms if they can't get an appointment with the doctor. So you're having a lot of access problems in Massachusetts, even though in this statistic it says more people have insurance. And so that's the big problem. I mean, a lot of people have Medicaid. Well, because the government cuts Medicaid reimbursement rates, less doctors and providers are accepting Medicaid payments. So it's harder to get treated if you have Medicaid. So I think that it's the wrong approach to sort of say that you have to focus on expanding insurance coverage. And I think the way that you bring down costs is by moving toward a more market-oriented system, which we do not have now. Right now, people get subsidized health care through their employer that's chosen to them, for them by their employer. The government mandates what type of services they have to be in a given plan. People don't have any idea what anything costs. There's no price transparency. People aren't directly paying for their health care because it's going through the government or through the insurance company or through their employer. So, I mean, basically, it's a black box. It's like somebody's walking into an electronics store, and there's no prices on anything, and somebody's picking up, and they're paying a copayment, and the person who doesn't have this insurance walks in, and everything's exorbitant for them. It's just an illogical system. And so the idea is to create a more transparent system, to create something that functions more like a market.
All right, let's go back to phone calls. Peter in Arcadia. Hi, Peter.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I'd like to ask your guest a couple of quick questions, if you would. Ask him to discuss the role of superdelegates in the Republican nomination process. And I think, at least among the Democrats, superdelegates are automatic delegates who are not beholden to a particular announced candidate for their vote when it comes time to nominating. And what is the percentage of superdelegates in the Republican Party? And also, does he think that the really big money fundraisers in the Republican Party, the Wall Street and big business, does he believe that they would be able to get behind a Herman Cain or a Michelle Bachmann?
I don't know off the top of my head what the exact percentage is of superdelegates. I believe the system is a bit different on the Republican side, and it's not quite an issue the way it was, particularly 4 years ago during the Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama nomination fight. And in terms of the big sort of money donors, I definitely think that there is trepidation between a Herman Cain or a Michelle Bachmann, among the sort of establishment types, because the question of how they'd stand up in the national stage, both to varying degrees, are untested. Michelle Bachmann, just a few years in the House of Representatives, with the reputation of being a bit of a bomb thrower, and Herman Cain, who is just now for the first time coming open to national scrutiny. The last time that we had we saw a candidate in a major party without any sort of prior experience, not being a general or a cabinet member at least, was Wendell Willkie, who of course lost to FDR. So, it would be pretty unprecedented for Cain to get the nomination. I definitely think he has that difficulty winning over the establishment.
Yeah. Thanks, Peter, for the call. Kelly in River Falls. Hi.
Hi. Good morning. I was just thinking, going back to my years in school, I would think that a high school teacher or a college professor would have a hard time describing those things that go on as debates, because there usually was issue-oriented, if I remember. But with regard to the immigration issue, there's talk about fences, and I'm wondering how that would, they didn't seem to address the issue of the fact that a lot of folks come through on tourist or student visas and just never go home, and all the fences in the world wouldn't fix that problem, but yet they don't bring that part up. And I don't see Mitt Romney or Perry going after Mitt Romney about his employment of a undocumented lawn worker as a policy. I see it as an attack, and I don't know where that fits into the idea of debate and policy. As far as Keynes' plan 999, if you ask any economist or tax person, it will shift the tax burden massively to the poor and the working classes. And one thing they forgot to mention was that it eliminates estate and capital gains taxes.
Philip.
In terms of the immigration, yes. I mean, definitely a lot of the people who are here illegally are coming over and overstaying their visas. And that's sort of a different issue that some conservatives will argue that the solution is higher, more enforcement on employers. But there's sort of a tension, and I didn't get to that in the earlier part. I mean, it's not clear to just say conservatives have this sort of monolithic view on immigration. It is sort of a debate among conservatives, because the more business community type conservatives tend to be more, for sort of a looser immigration policy, because businesses in some cases depend on illegal immigrant workers. So that sort of attention within the conservative movement on that. But I'd say that most, conservatives who, want to see something done on immigration look toward more enforcement on employers who hire illegal immigrants as a way to deal with the problem in terms of the visa overextending one's visa.
Whatever your viewpoint is, it does seem it's yet another instance where we need very, very long deliberations on what our policy ought to be in this country. We keep just not making decisions on immigration.
Yeah, I mean, the big issue on immigration, I always say it's probably the only issue that sort of touches on, it's kind of a social issue, the culture, the whole idea in terms of people talking about the culture and the effect of the culture of mass immigration. So that's one aspect of it. There's the economic issue, the idea of are they displacing American workers versus do we need the labor? And there's the national security issue. If we don't secure our border, does that make it easier for not just someone who's coming over here to, get a job, but somebody who's coming over here to, engage in crime or even terrorism? That's sort of, it's one of those issues that cuts through everything. And I think the difficulty is that both parties are kind of divided through various wings. I think that, even the Democratic side, I think that, between unions and, Hispanic Democrats, I think that you see differing views on immigration, for instance, sometimes. So I think that It's a very difficult issue to come to a conclusion on. I think that one of the reasons why conservatives are so trepidatious about, because obviously you get to the problem of, there's two issues. How do you sort of make future immigrants come in here or the future immigration policy more rational? And then what do you do with the people that are already here? And those are two different, different issues. And the problem is Democrats want to sort of say, well, let's deal with them both at the same time. But and that's what Bush wanted to do. But the problem is that if you go back to 1986, when Reagan granted amnesty in exchange for securing the border, Republicans went along with that, but then it didn't secure the border, and the amnesty came anyway. So that's why a lot of conservatives are suspicious, because prior promises of trading amnesty to more border security and more enforcement, you got the amnesty without the border security and enforcement. So they're very trepidatious when people say, oh, well, comprehensive immigration reform, cap to citizenship, and securing the border. They don't trust the government to actually secure the border. They want to say, secure the border first, stop the flow of illegal immigrants, and then we can talk about ways to deal with those who are already here.
Our guest this hour is senior editorial writer for the Washington Examiner, Philip Klein. We have a couple lines open now. They've been crowded. If you'd like to join the conversation, well, why don't you do so? The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And next hour, Diane Ravitch will be joining us, historian of education, educational policy analyst, and research professor at NYU. The question came up, why are students doing so well in Finland? And we'll start with that. She has a lot to say about educational policy coming from the federal government, which she is not in favor of, wasn't for the Bush administration, and well, she was initially, but then grew disenchanted. She's not in favor of what's going on in the Obama administration, and she feels that teachers are just not being given trust and respect. And she will be with us, our number two. Stay where you are. If you're on hold, we'll be with your calls momentarily on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hugh from Milwaukee, our next caller. Hi, Hugh.
Hi. A Democratic debate would not have a big issue of immigration, but it is a big issue for Republicans, and it should be a big issue for all Americans. Reagan didn't have the amnesty, and there are 12 million reasons why it failed, because we have approximately 12 million illegals in the country now. If you want a good jobs bill, ignore Obama and deport the illegals and make sure American citizens get the jobs. The problem with Perry, and it's not only the in Texas, many of which go to illegals, it's not only his favoritism of giving special chances at university for illegals, and the same chances that they would deny to people from Oklahoma or Arizona. But culturally, you had in Texas just the other day, you had a teacher having her pupils give the Pledge of Allegiance to the Mexican flag in a Spanish class. You know, in Arizona, they know the hatred of America that's being taught in many of these bilingual classes. They know the anti-Anglo, anti-American, and pro-Mexican propaganda that's being taught in these language classes. It goes on in Texas, too. Why doesn't Perry demand the firing of the teacher? When are they to be pledging allegiance? And the only reason we know about it is one of the gals videotaped it and was horrified.
And where did you find the information, Hugh? I haven't seen this report. Where is it reported?
Why can't we celebrate Columbus anymore? Your station doesn't do anything on the man who, you know, multiculturalism is a disaster, and it's related to immigration.
Hugh, I just want to know, where is your information coming from concerning giving the allegiance to the Mexican flag?
It was go on Google. I read it on some of the things. I can't remember which now. It's just in the past few days. Look up Mexican flag, Texas, and the teacher who did it, and it's only a student. I think it was on Fox News, but I'm not sure. Okay.
Okay, Philip.
Well, I'll just say, you know, I'd spoken up in the last segment about the sort of how immigration touches on cultural issues, economic issues, and national security issues, and I think that if you hear the caller, I think what he's sort of expressing is particularly on the cultural issue in terms of what's the question about absorbing, you know, a lot more immigrants into our country. And I think that the question is that some people argue because I'm generally very pro-immigration, but one of the arguments you'll hear is that there's sort of a difference between immigration 100 years ago, where immigrants tried to assimilate into America and become American, and whereas now, where you're seeing, because of multiculturalism, people trying to sort of recreate their cultures in America. And so I think that's what the frustration that he was getting at by talking about the sort of Pledge of Allegiance to a Mexican flag. I didn't see that story, so I can't speak to it.
And what about, you know, everybody is saying that the Democrats are very liberal on this issue. The president has faced a great deal of criticism recently because he has deported over 1 million illegal immigrants in 2.5 years. He's on pace to deport more in one term than George W. Bush did in two.
Yeah, and I think also, I mean, you have another reason is you have the economy, and I think that part of it is that also less Mexican immigrants are coming into the country because there aren't as many opportunities as there were a few years ago, and also the argument of, quote-unquote, you know, jobs Americans won't do, which is a big argument as to whether these are jobs Americans won't do. Clearly, in a bad economy where a lot of Americans are struggling, they're more open to doing certain jobs that maybe they otherwise wouldn't be. So for those reasons, I think that you see economic factors also leading to a sort of, tapering off in terms of the flow of immigrants.
Thank you, Philip, very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Philip Klein, senior editorial writer for the Washington Examiner. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production in our downtown Milwaukee studios. Thanks for all of your calls. And thank you for listening. And thank you for making that pledge drive we just ended really successful. It was a good idea, and you helped out. We made $1 million. Isn't that incredible? Thank you. I know times are rough. Thanks. We'll be back.